here, and I really can't say much about this air that I breathe. You see, I've been complaining for weeks to the Motel 6 concierge about the smell and my general breathing problems, but they insist that I should probably go and see a doctor. One thing I can say is that our Young Loving correspondent reports that Andrea Barrett smells quite pleasant, perhaps even more pleasant than I ever will. So we can be somewhat thankful that her book's title lived up to its atmospheric promise.
Okay, so I'm here with Andrea Barrett, who is the author of Ship Fever, and most recently, The Air We Breathe. Andrea, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. First, I wanted to actually ask you about the sort of common environment, I think. Much of this wartime environment reminded me of certain contemporary issues, and I'm wondering to what degree is this kind of your own reflective prism of current events in terms of the accusatory nature of rounding up certain types of ethnicities, and to what degree does this reflect kind of a universal wartime oppression?
It is meant to reflect what's going on now. Occasionally people say, oh, there's all these resemblances between 1916 and now. Is that accidental? And no, it's not accidental. It's very much meant. I've never been good about writing about contemporary situations that upset or concern me as they happen, but my way is usually to go back into history and try and find a situation that feels analogous to me that I can contemplate a little more dispassionately and see if I can build a situation there that will reflect what's going on now.
Gotcha. I'm curious about how 1916 entered the equation. Why that particular year? Did this come from your research looking into Sanark Lake, which you actually did the initial research that inspired the tuberculosis institution in this, the sanctuary?
It was really the conflation of two things. The book is a kind of homage to and response to the Magic Mountain.
Yes.
So if you remember the Magic Mountain, it's a bunch of rich people in a wealthy private sanatorium. And the bulk of that book takes place between 1907 and 1914, which is to say just as Europe was entering World War I. So when I tried to think about making an American analog, I was trying to think about people who were poor rather than rich, who were immigrants and lower class rather than upper class. It's set in a public sanatorium rather than a private sanatorium. And the analog in time is not the same time for America. The analog in time is 1916, which is when we're just poised on this cusp. Are we going to enter the war? Are we not going to enter the war? There are a lot of passionate arguments going on then. So that's why that particular year. And that was further reinforced in the months and years after September 11th, when things started to change so sharply here. 1916 also began to look like a sharper and sharper analog to what was going on in the country.
Mm-hmm. Got you. I mean, speaking of Magic Mountain, Leo happens to be half German. Was he sort of, it's Carl, I believe, who's the protagonist in that particular book, and I'm wondering how much he was reflecting that protagonist in terms of Thomas Mann.
Leo Marburg comes from Russia. He's a Russian citizen, but as is true for many people... As is true for many people in the more European end of Russia, he's not ethnically Russian at all. He's ethnically Baltic German, some Polish. He's Jewish on his mother's side, although her parents have converted. So I was trying to make in him the kind of classically hybrid American. Most of us, myself included, have strands from many different ethnicities and many different backgrounds. And I wanted to reflect that in him, but I specifically wanted to give him a German name so that during this time he would at least be poised to come under suspicion during the great wave of anti-German hysteria that went on.
Why did you feel that it was important to dwell upon the immigrant experience and the lower classes and that kind of thing? I mean, you do have Miles in this book who reflects more of an upper-class blowhard of some sort, you know.
Yeah.
So is this meant to be sort of an inversion of man or what?
It really is meant to be inversion. Take the whole structure of the Magic Mountain and turn it on its head. In the Magic Mountain, you not only don't see patients who don't have any money, you don't see the workers in the sanatorium, you don't see the maids, you don't see the cooks, you don't see the people who are shoveling the snow. What you see is just that surface of privilege. So I wanted to go underneath all that and see what was happening there. And the reason for Leo to be an immigrant is partly for that inversion and partly because that's who was in the big public sanatoria at that time. Those were run by either the state or the municipality. They were supported by taxpayers. people who lived in large urban areas were sent there partly to get better. It's not entirely malignant, but also partly to remove them from the wealthy people around them so that people wouldn't catch the disease. So it's a double-edged sword going on there.
I'm wondering, in your research, did you find a kind of Miles-like figure who was occupying a public sanctuary, sanatorium, as opposed to a private one? Or were there many of these types of figures?
There were a lot of wealthy people in cure cottages. I didn't find someone like Miles. He's really wholly invented. But the American Protective League is real, that institution that he belongs to. Was real and very powerful during the early part of World War I. So I really built him from my knowledge of people in cure cottages, which I had written about before in a story called The Cure and Servants of the Map, and then from what I found out about the American Protective League.
Gotcha. These sessions that Miles conducts are rather interesting, because we don't actually know all the time what's actually being reported in those sessions. You do reproduce a rather bland page-long sentence of some of the things that are discussed, but I found that to be kind of an interesting decision in light of the first-person plural narration, which we haven't even begun to discuss. I'm wondering why you kept that sort of disguise. Was this a way of also kind of foreshadowing the inevitable revelation of who this particular narrator is?
Yeah, I wanted to, this collective narrator. Usually when we read something that starts off with a we voice, we're waiting for it to separate out into an I, and that is the case with most stories. This doesn't, right through the very end, and there's a reason for that. And partly the reason is that as a group, those people do something, or in some cases fail to do something, about which they feel really guilty, and so they're not willing to separate out. The reason for reproducing what they're talking about so literally is partly to give you a sense of the real texture of their lives and what they're really learning. There was a tendency then, and there's still a tendency now, to think that recent immigrants to this country, if they're working in menial jobs, aren't educated and don't have complicated intellectual lives, and that's just silly. It was silly then, and it's silly now. The workmen's circles, which is what that discussion group is based on, were very common in New York, especially on the Lower East Side. People talked in great depth and with great rigor after very long days working horrible jobs about the Yiddish theater, about French music, about painting, about all sorts of things. And I thought that just to describe those things, to tell about those things very briefly, would in a sense be unbelievable, that I needed to reproduce for you some of the texture of that to imagine, so that you could fully imagine what it was like to really have those discussions.
And yet there's also a bit of a mystery in not actually discussing the full minutes of the agenda of what's being done. Were there two green volumes that you actually found during the course of your research?
I have those two green volumes.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I have the books that Leo works from. And I know them almost as well as Leo does at this point, although I don't actually know any chemistry, but I do treasure
them. Come on, cite something at the top of your head right now.
I can't. I just can't. But I could when I was writing the book. 19th century science, even when it was cutting-edge science then, it's 100 years or 150 years later now, which means I can understand it now. I can't understand current chemistry, but I can understand chemistry that was published in 1887. So it wasn't a big mystery to wend through those volumes.
Is this one of the reasons why you have continually returned to this particular historical epoch where science along these lines is discussed? I mean, actually, I should also point out that science during that time, one of the reasons why amateurs could, in fact, pursue this kind of thing is because there wasn't so much of it. You know, I mean, if we look at the whole knowledge doubles every 5 years, thing, it becomes a bit of a nightmare trying to, you have to be niche and specialized.
That is part of what draws me. In the mid and late 19th century, almost up until the time of the First World War, there was less science in general, and it was less fragmented, and it was written about in terms that were more accessible to the layperson. So people in general society could and did read about discoveries in anthropology and physics and mathematics and chemistry. It was part of the common discussion of the time. We've lost that almost entirely because there's so much stuff and it's so difficult and it's so fragmented. But Yes, it's very appealing to read the science of that time. It's very interesting, and it's wonderful to feel included in the discourse.
But also, it's extremely deadly, as we see in the basement and with the X-ray and the ancient X-ray that isn't protected by the radiation, and this really grisly image of the hand essentially wrapped in aluminum foil. What is left of it? I mean, the idea of the X-ray machine in the basement almost seems to me reminiscent of a certain kind of the dark underbelly of science. Was this kind of what you were going for with this? Or?
Yeah, it was. That time, just the time in the First World War, before the war was really the last time when, as a culture, we could imagine science as wholly benign, as something that was only going to help people, as something that was only full of intellectual excitement. It is the First World War, really, that brings us the dark underbelly of science. It's when X-rays are discovered and then they're found to be damaging. It's when the chemical and dye industry is bringing all these wonderful things to light, and at the same time they're making poison gas. It's when cars are invented and then they turn into tanks. It's when airplanes are invented and they drop bombs. Everything gets turned so quickly in the First World War into darkness.
In terms of the actual perspective of this time period, I was curious what steps you took to really ensure the verisimilitude of this. Like, for example, you have a moment in which a character comments upon the length of a skirt, and I was rather amused by that because I was like, oh, well, that's a rather long skirt. But also, you know, this idea of some of the doctors who were describing what is going on across the big pond, and it was a larger ocean back then with the technology not being as progressive as it is now, but describing the horrors of gas and the like. What did you do to sort of ensure that you were being faithful to this time period in terms of the character's perception? Or is this a matter of just really plunging into research like this?
I do plunge into research, but with a very particular bent, which is that I tend not to read things that are written now or after the event about that time. What I try to do is to read everything those people then would have read. So if I'm working with an X-ray technician, I have at home the X-ray textbook that was written in 1910 that she would have used to train herself. If I have someone talking about poison gas and the way it's made in World War I, I have the chemistry papers that describe making the gas from them, and I have the medical reports and the army documents that describe the first effects of those. So I just soak myself in the period as if I were a contemporary of that period. Clothes are easy. I just look at magazines and ads.
Oh, really? You do that for all the material you write about?
Yeah, I rummage around in old magazines and old pamphlets and old newspapers, and not just the articles, but the advertisements are wonderfully helpful. I have ladies' home journals from 1914, so I can see, you know, where the pockets go on a dress and what length Naomi's skirt is, and that rickrack on her pocket I took from a Singer sewing machine pattern.
I actually want to talk about the sort of the superficial environment, in the sense of you have the X-ray machine, you have the sketching and the like, and you even have many allusions in the imagery to ribs. Even the trees are described as ribs. Was this an effort to kind of show that this was essentially almost a kind of ethereal environment that they were in? And it seemed to be, you know, really sort of in a certain sense showing just, and it's not a matter of recuperating, it's also a matter of surviving this effort not to be able to see concrete, transparent, explicit sorts of objects around you. So what of this?
That's wonderful and largely unconscious. I mean, any writer, the patterns of imagery that develop in our work, usually we don't see it all when we start. Some of them become clear as we go through multiple drafts. I was aware with the X-rays and with the sketching and with the kind of thwarted love quartet that there were a lot of images related to seeing, being seen, not being seen clearly, being seen through. But what you say about the ribs and the nature of the body, I actually wasn't aware of. And that's what readers bring back to us. We often can't see what we've set up in terms of patterns of imagery in a novel. That's probably good. It comes from our unconscious. If we thought about it too hard, it would maybe be too studied.
Gotcha. Well, the love quartet, how did that kind of come into place? Because it's A loves B, B loves C, C loves, you know, it's really quite a bit of a mess. Does this come from, I guess, the propagation of characters? Because there's a magnificent genealogical tree at the end of this particular book that shows all the characters in your collected works. And I'm wondering if a name just enters into your particular imagination, and it just can't help but be fleshed out into some three-dimensional character.
That's sort of what happens. Sometimes people ask me, did I have the whole tree first and I just write different wings? No, I don't and didn't have the whole tree. They just, wings pop up, people pop up, and sometimes I think they're wholly unrelated to anyone else, and then I write for a while and it turns out, oh, that's the cousin of so-and-so, or oh, that's so-and-so's grandmother. Of course that's what she's doing in Saranac Lake. And so they get woven into that tapestry of the genealogy. And that is partly how the love quartet, as it were, arose. I had a certain set of people, and I was trying to think about how they interacted. And they just arranged themselves in that way, and in a sense it was kind of an accident.
So really it's a matter of actually having characters lust and love after each other to actually get them together, really.
Yeah, yeah. So they just started spinning around each other in that form.
I wanted to actually talk about the idea of the intellectual involvement in this sanitarium, where you have war, essentially, this influence of war corrupting the innovation that's going on, the intellectual discourse, the great zeal to study the x-rays and the like. I mean, was it more a case of war entering the equation later during the writing process, or was it there from the beginning? And was this juxtaposition of war versus science really kind of what you were trying to sort of get at in terms of, like, getting these characters together?
It entered before I finished the first draft, but it was not what I intended initially. I thought I was going to do more of a more purely a response to the Magic Mountain, which in that book too, the war doesn't really enter until the end,
sure.
And then Hans goes off stage. I thought I would have a bunch of people talking and thinking and falling in love, and largely unresponsive to the war. I think that was naive of me. How did I think I was going to set a novel in 1916 and not have people influenced by the war? But certainly it was affected by what went on in this country during the years I was writing it and by my own responses to it. I've not largely been a political writer before, nor have I been overtly a political person, but the events of the last few years have changed things in me, and that has changed my writing. And it also changed, I think, the course of the novel through many drafts. I began to let them be influenced as I was being influenced, I think.
But do you think there's a danger when you're allowing politics to kind of creep onto the page that did you have to kind of curtail some of the didacticism or some of the sort of fury you may have felt about current events?
I did. I had to think all the time, well, I want to let these analogous events come in, but I don't want to let them distort what's going on between the characters, and I don't want to let them completely take over the book either. I want Leo to retain his love for chemistry and to try and reconnect with his earlier life during this brief period in the sanatorium. I want Eudora to go out and learn this new thing in her life. So, yes, I'm always juggling those things.
Yeah. The character names are rather amusing. Dr. Petrie, I mean, you even have a moment where you describe the look on his face that really resembles the inside of a Petri dish.
Yeah.
As well as Miles, which, you know, you sort of implies that he can kind of talk on for miles. How do these kind of, literations to some degree actually enter in the equation? I mean, there's some names that are not so explicit, and there's some that are. So what actually creates a choice like that to happen?
Some of them just pop up. Some were predetermined. Leo Marburg is a character I wrote about before. He was an elderly man when I first brought him to life in the Marburg sisters. Here he's a young man, so I didn't get to do anything with him. I had to invent a backstory that would explain the name rather than fit the name to him. Miles Fairchild, I love what you say about the Miles. For me, the significant part of that name is Fairchild, the sense of him as being someone of hope and optimism, who he quite turns out not to be, so that's meant to be an ironic thing. Dr. Petrie is just a little joke. Some people will get it and some people won't. For me too, the Petri dish. And others, it's just the sound. I love the sound of the name Eudora, so it was just purely the...
I didn't know if it was Eudora Welty or...
Partly an homage to that, too. I love her work, and so this name floated into my brain, and it had the right number of syllables, it had the right sound for the woman I conceived her to be, and I love Eudora Welty, so I kept that.
Gotcha. I was going to ask you about the sort of staggered ages. You have Leo is 27, Miles is 37, and the young girl is 17. So there's a 10-year increment. I found that very interesting. Is this the kind of thing you need to do to get your characters together by just creating sort of a scenario? I'm curious.
I didn't actually think of that. That's very funny. I knew they were spread out, but I didn't realize they were spread out by 10-year. Wow. No, I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm just wondering if how much of this is actually planned. Do you outline, or do you actually allow yourself to kind of ramble? Because I don't know if you're one of those persons who, if you actually go ahead and outline something, you're going to kind of create lots of things on top of that. Maybe you can kind of describe how these...
I wish, but I am the most chaotic of writers. Okay. I don't know anything. When I start, I don't know who my characters are. I don't know what the situation is. I don't know what the plot is. I don't know who I'm going to keep. I just start almost from nowhere, and then I just wander around for a really long time. Eventually some strand or person or set of persons will pop up and that will seem interesting, and I'll discard a lot of stuff and start poking at that. And then over the course of many, many drafts, I'm really a very clumsy writer. The story will start to emerge and I'll start to see what I'm doing. And then I can revise towards that once I start to get a picture.
Gotcha. It's something of a cruel joke that 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the 1916 version, is actually canceled in lieu of wartime footage.
Yeah.
Because here you have this fantasy film involving a submarine, essentially kind of uprooted by war footage, and of course the U-boats were a big part of that. So I'm wondering,
right,
in terms of this realist versus fantasy kind of thing, it's almost as if this represents the moment in which America kind of looks the other way. They are denied their lovely little fantasy for a very influential fantasy film, by the way, you know.
Again, I have to say that's a brilliant reading, and that went totally past me. I had a chance to see the 1916 version.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Well, you know, the magic of DVDs,
yeah,
you can do this now. So I knew about the film, but I hadn't seen the whole thing, and I was able to go and get a copy and watch it all. And it's strangely moving to look at now. It is such a gigantic fantasy, but I didn't think about that fantasy reality thing. I just thought, oh, submarines, U-boats, there's something interesting with the images here, and I didn't really make that reading that you did, and I like that very much. Thank you for that.
Well, no problem. I wanted to actually ask you about this this really regrettable historical fiction rap that you have, in terms of people want to label you into this taxonomy of, oh, well, she writes about stuff that isn't contemporary, therefore it's historical fiction. I mean, what of this? I mean, you know, we had a good long run in literature in which people didn't identify something that was set, you know, 100 years ago as historical fiction until perhaps only the last 30 or 40 years, I would say. Why do you think this label exists? Are people reluctant to sort of look upon the past without this modifier? Or?
I don't know. It really puzzles me. It's like saying, I don't know, women's fiction or African-American fiction. What is that? Why do we want to push everything into these little ghettos? Science fiction, right. I don't think of what I do as historical fiction. I do write fiction that's set in other times, but I also write fiction that's set in this time. For me, it's quite a fluid continuum. I have a story to tell, and I find a place in time that is the right place for the story. It all looks the same to me, then, now, very then, almost now. I research in the same way, whether it's a contemporary story or a historical piece, because I almost never write from my own experience. I have to learn what my characters are doing. So if I'm setting something in 2004 about a marine biologist, I have to go out and learn the texture of that woman's life, the same way that I have to learn the texture of somebody's life in 1916. It doesn't compartmentalize that way for me, but I'm aware that it does for some people.
Do you find it's harder to actually dwell upon contemporary settings as opposed to historical ones, because you're actually, a lot of the people are still existing, a lot of the constructs are still existing, or do you find it easier to gravitate towards the past and find these analogous parallels?
It depends whether it's right now or 10 years before right now. I can go back 7 and 10 years quite comfortably, almost as comfortably as I can go back 150 years. I almost never can write about, you know, right now, and that's usually because there's a lot of emotional content attached to it, not only for me, but for everyone who's involved in it. It's hard to step back and really understand what's happening right now. At least it is for me, although I love novelists who can go in and sort of put their finger on the pulse right now and get something. I can't do that. I need a little more distance.
I'm just wondering if the fact that, like, people are dead and they're not going to go ahead and quibble about the authenticity, maybe this might actually be sort of a fringe benefit towards writing about the past.
It would be if I used real people, but almost all my characters are invented.
Historians are going to nitpick.
Yeah, sometimes I'll write about Linnaeus or Mendel, or sometimes a real scientist or a character will walk through the edge of a story, but generally the central characters in my work are all invented, so it sort of doesn't matter whether they're dead or alive.
One thing we haven't really talked about is Saranac Lake and why you chose this as the model for the sanitarium in question. And I was curious as to what was kind of transposed directly from your research and what was invented. I mean, we talked about miles being invented, so what were there any other details about this particular place?
The geography is altered. Saranac Lake, for me, that's just serendipity. There were sanatoria all over Saranac Lake, but also there were very many in the hills of North Carolina. There were a lot in Colorado. They were in Northern California, they were up around Portland. But Saranac Lake is the place I know. I lived in Rochester for a lot of years, and I went very often to the Adirondacks to climb and hike and ski. So I just knew the geography, and it's always seemed very beautiful to me. And I also, that's where I became aware of these houses covered with porches and started to think, what are those porches for? And when I first found out they were covered with people trying to cure their tuberculosis, that's really what set off these years of research for me. It was easy for me to visit, which I did often, and to look at the geography and the landscape and the architecture. So inevitably, that's where I did my first real research, was in the library up at Saranac Lake. The reason I gave it a different name in the book is that as a novelist, I often feel quite confined by the actual surround of the past. It's better for the book and better for me as a writer. If I change the name, I can do things like change the number of miles between the sanatorium and the town, which turns out to be important in this book because characters are moving back and forth between the two. I can change the architecture of the big public sanatorium in the town, which is also important in this book. It is very important both in terms of the plot and symbolically that this be a building that has two separate wings, one for men, one for women, separated by a central building. There were lots of sanatoria like that. I used as a model one in North Carolina, but the one in Saranac Lake doesn't actually look like that, so that's why I make those sorts of decisions.
And also the fire drastically disrupts the architecture, and you really get a sense of how important that is and how disruptive this is.
Yeah, and I really needed a building that was shaped that way to make the fire work in the way that it does in the novel.
Was the fire in place from the get-go, or...?
I did always know there would be a fire. What I didn't know is how the fire was going to happen, and that was a surprise to me.
Interesting. So a few reviewers have quibbled with this book about, well, we know who actually was the arsonist here and all that, but I wanted to ask you, is who did it not so much a concern of you as the environment as to this particular thing? I mean, why do you think some of these critics have really been pushing for, I need narrative that surprises me? Is this a kind of a sort of danger in dwelling upon a time period that people suddenly perhaps expect by way of entering the past? It's, oh, well, there's historical research, therefore there'll be a really sophisticated plot. I mean, in this kind of manner, what is what I mean. So what of this kind of...
I think it's movie culture. Of course you know who the arsonist is. You're meant to know that the arsonist is. It isn't like I was trying to make that the mystery of the book. I would have done that more actively if that was my primary concern. Clearly this didn't work for everybody, but my intent in laying the clues of how the fire takes place rather obviously through the book was actually to divert your attention from that mystery, which is only, that's a cheap mystery. That's the mystery of a movie. That's the easy whodunit. And to try to turn your attention towards the mystery of why? Why is this group of patients acting like this? Why do they turn on one of their own? Why don't they stand up to Miles? What's going on politically and in terms of the atmosphere in the country that makes them act like this? That to me is the more interesting mystery. And that's the same mystery we feel now. Why do we act the way we do as a country? You know, why did the media not speak out more against the war when the war started? How did we get involved in this? Why did people protest so little until so late? Those are the things that are really interesting me. So that's why the that event of the plot is as transparent as it is.
But it's also kind of funny because these people should know. They should put two and two together. And actually, I was amused by the fact that these supporting characters just really could not figure out who did it. And to me, it struck me as kind of funny. You know, I mean, I was wondering if this was kind of more your intent to just sort of show that, like, the fact that perception had been muddled so horribly with this. It was more of a interest than just, you know, the actual movie culture mystery that you're talking about.
That was actually exactly my intention. By signaling their inability to read what to us is a fairly transparent chain of events, I did mean to signal how occluded their vision is. We were talking earlier in the interview about how much of the imagery of the book centers around vision and failure of vision and confusion of vision, and that was meant to work in that same way, to let their vision be clouded by the fear, by the suspicion, by the paranoia, so that they can't even solve this relatively straightforward mystery, in quotation marks.
Gotcha. Was Miles based on anyone specific? I mean, was there an actual Edward like figure that he was corresponding with? If it was based on anyone specific, did you uncover letters or anything along these lines?
No, he really is just a pure invention. I'm sure there were people like him, but I don't know of them.
Maybe I think I'll talk to you more about this notion of how a name becomes a fully fleshed out figure. Have there ever been in your career certain names that you have been unable to kind of pursue and flesh out because they just didn't call attention to their own sort of personality? Are there people that maybe you regret or that you actually attempted to pursue? I'm just curious from a sort of writing standpoint as to some of the missteps you may have made in terms of your quite febrile imagination on this point.
I don't think I've had, I can't remember having a misstep like that in terms of a simple character name. My missteps tend to be much larger than that, and they're very large indeed. Sometimes I will be sure I'm writing a story and it turns into a novel. Sometimes I'm sure I'm writing a novel, it turns out to be a long story. I have started books 30 years later than they actually wanted to start. I have ended them too early. I have started them in the middle. I've started a book at every place but the right place. I don't think I've ever started a book at what turned out to be its actual beginning. Often I'm not even close. Often I misconceive who the central character is for hundreds of pages sometimes. So for me, misnaming a character, it's like, I should be so lucky. That's the little kind of mistake.
But does a central character really matter sometimes? I mean, your novels are often, you know, rather populated. You know what I mean?
They are. It probably matters to other people more than it matters to me. My imagination is a lot about connections, is a lot about patterns of relationship between sets of people, 4, 6, 8 people. It's our culture's way right now to want to read for a singular hero. That may also be related again to movies and to television. We want a single protagonist moving clearly through a single set of events in a confined period of time. That's how a lot of stuff works right now. So people say, oh, well, this book is really about Leo. And it's like, not so much. I mean, it is about Leo, and it's about Eudora, and it's about Miles, and it's about Irene, and it's about Naomi. It's about their relationships. So in that sense, me not knowing who the central character is for a while is probably less important than it would be for another writer.
So essentially, literary culture, you'd say, is in trouble because of this grounding in rudimentary narratives as opposed to more complex ones.
I would not say literary culture is in trouble in the sense of writers. I think there's an incredible amount of wonderful writing going on right now in very diverse forms. I would say in the larger culture, people's ability, critics' ability, even readers' ability to understand those forms is maybe a little diminished over what it used to be.
What do you think will be the solution to this, to get people to really parse these mammoth texts or these intricacies more fluidly?
You know, I'm a teacher as well as a writer, so my way is to think, well, if I just get people to read more when they're young, they'll stay good at this and they'll be better at that. And that's part of what I do when I'm teaching writing and reading, is to try and feed my students texts that are complicated, texts that do things. I love movies, but if I wanted to write a book that could be turned into a movie, I would just write a movie already. I'd write a screenplay or I'd make a movie. It's a different form. I love books that do that which movies can't do, which is a lot. You know, in a good novel, you have a way, you have access to inner lies and to inner patterns that just can't be done in film. Film does its own brilliant thing that books can't do, but books do something that movies can't do, and those are the things I try to get my students to read in the hopes that they'll retain that complexity.
What have you seen in terms of how has your teaching career helped you as a writer?
It makes me read more widely, among other things. It makes me read more because I'm always looking for things to bring to my students. And it makes me read more deeply as well as widely. I never learn a book as well as I do when I have to teach it, no matter how well I think I know it. When I have to bring it to 12 students the next day, I sort of gut and fillet it in a wholly different way.
I'm curious, what books have you taught the most frequently?
I change my reading list all the time. I almost never repeat anything because I like to stay really interested too. But, certain things, certain writers I bring back often to them. Chekhov, Tolstoy, Alice Munro. There's a whole slew of different people. But I like to bring them to writers who are a little more reflective. I'm very fond of the Canadian writer Mavis Gallant, who writes a long, complicated, penetrating sort of story that, again, is virtually unfilmable and yet brings a fullness of experience. The students are very surprised when they read her. They say, oh, how do you get to write a 40-page story and get away with that? It's like, well, you just have to be really good.
Is that the criteria for good fiction, unfilmable?
No, there's lots of good fiction that's filmable. It's just my criteria for the kind of fiction I want to write. I set that as a personal goal for myself some time back. I want to write the kind of book that really nobody can film.
Huh. I'm wondering if movie people have tried to approach you anyway in light of this particular criteria.
A few people sniffed around The Voyage of the Narwhal, but yeah. I suspect that if someone had filmed it, I'm very fond of The English Patient, and that's also not a bad movie, but the reason it's not a bad movie, arguable, I know, but the reason that it exists as a coherent movie is it's one tiny strand of the novel plucked out from the fabric of the novel and followed, and that is the only way you could have made a movie out of that good book. And had someone done The Voyage of the Narwhal, I can't imagine what strand they would have pulled, but I feel sure it would have been a strand and it would have been focused on one character, probably Erasmus. Everybody else would have fallen away. How else could you do it?
Yeah, the central character scenario, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Well, Andrea, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right.
Just trying to breathe. It's my world till it's time to leave. Just trying to breathe. It's my world till it's time to leave. Just trying to breathe. It's my world till it's time to leave. Just trying to breathe.
The summer felt like the winter, and I ain't talking about weather. I see a cold world like the jizzer. It's a blizzard out here, you holding twist up. But don't sneak tobacco in my Rizla. I'm from where they jackass, where they Turkish link. Swatch watches, feline, Lecoq sportif. They took Jordan 1 and 2s right off your feet. If you fought back and won, then you caught more beef. The 80s were so crazy, cats are still afraid of Daryl Gates, the chokehold, cracking gangs. I hustled, but I made it through a crack in the game. While a lot of homies got trapped back in the day, from where ugly pollution brings a beautiful haze. Sunset rays, orange lavender.